Okay. And we are back. We're back with John Garvey. John, hello.
Hello, Sean. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you again. Last time we recorded together, it was sort of the introductory episode for what's to be a mini series. I'm going to go ahead and call this like episode one.
Okay.
Of Garveyism. And I have a great song to put in for the theme song. I'll talk to Andy about it. But are you familiar with the song Marcus Garvey by the Slackers? I think it is.
No.
Oh, it's a very good song. And I think it's be a good intro. It's Andy was the one that came up with the idea of playing with Garveyism, you know, as like a title for this stuff. So do you have any opinions on Marcus Garvey?
It's interesting. Not, you know, I haven't thought about it a lot in a long time, but there was a moment when perhaps I was most sympathetic to the significance of black nationalism or proto-nationalism in U.S. history. And one of the odd things I remember is at one point, apparently Lenin and the other folks in the what became the Comintern, they wanted to extend an invitation to Garvey to join.
Garvey?
Yeah.
Wow, interesting.
And I think that, I mean, there's probably some downsides to that because that then, that was a signal that the then Soviet Union was embracing a somewhat unprincipled position vis-a-vis nationalism that had... you know, really bad consequences in a lot of different places, and that to some extent endured. That, you know, if you think about all of the terrible ends of national liberation struggles in the better part of the 20th century, that it's not and a very happy story.
Into the 21st century.
Into the 21st as well.
As we grapple with Zionism, with Ukrainian nationalism, with great Russian nationalism, the return of all these various different nationalisms. It's maybe a mistake, I think, to tie our start to that. But the idea was that it was historically progressive because it was...
I guess also that it was a hint of what was to come, which was in some ways a much more positive thing, was the embrace of the significance of the black liberation movement, you know, in the United States in particular and some other places, as one of the kinds of thing that, in the way that C.L.R. James eventually imagined, that it was an independent contributor to the development of a proletarian movement. And that, of course, turned out to be so, if you think, you know. And probably, like I said, I haven't studied Garveyism in a long time, and probably the kind of the knowledge about him has increased significantly since I did. But the my hunch is that there were people. I mean, there was a group called the African Blood Brotherhood, which Hubert Harrison, I believe, was the most prominent member, and they were, it seems to me, people who are living on the borderline between revolutionary black nationalism and revolutionary communism of a certain kind. I don't know that they would have articulated it quite that way, but that there are, I mean, if you think, you know, in a different context of this, out of the where the Northern Ireland civil rights movement, typified by Bernadette Devlin, how it developed, it went way beyond the confines of where it began. And that's true for a lot of movements that they have that character. And I would guess that that was true of Garveyism as well. Whether Garvey himself realized all that is, of course, a separate question.
Garvey is I think he's a contradictory figure, right? If we can say so. He ends up getting busted for tax evasion. Yeah. But you have to, I mean, that just seems like, to me, state repression. I think anybody can be brought up for tax evasion if the feds want to get them. Started the Black Star Lines, right? Was an attempt to create a black-owned business. So there were shades of like Booker T. Washington and, you know, uplift theory. But there was also shades of like Pan-Africanism in the New World, right? This idea of uniting black folks, black, I wouldn't even say workers because that wasn't the terms that they were used, but black folks from the Caribbean to parts of South America and certainly North America and the Black Belt, uniting them into some sort of common struggle, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, Du Bois and Garvey hated each other, as far as I know. But, you know, later on, like Garvey's wife, Amy Jacques Garvey, she was a fairly prominent member of the emerging Pan-African movement in the United Kingdom. She was a close associate with C.L.R. James and George Padmore. So that, you know, kind of the, you know, I think she probably by that point had moved quite a bit beyond where her husband had been when they were together. But I think that the origins deserve some acknowledgement.
For sure. I mean, you say you don't know that much about it, but you know who his wife is and you know her ties in Britain. So obviously you do know some things. And that's why you're here, John, because you have this wealth of knowledge. I know you're a very humble person. And that's, I think, partially also why we're having you here, is because you'd be the last to admit that you've got a ton of experience and a ton of reading and a ton of theory.
Ton of experience is only due to years.
Well, you're doing better than a lot of us, that's for sure. This recording session, I will admit, took some time to get together, and I think it was some combination of medical issues and then technical issues on my end. But it's been nice ferrying up and down the hill, because you and I'm not going to dox either of us, but we live very close to one another.
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
So for the last couple of weeks, I've been going up and down the hill and collecting equipment and coming to visit, and you've been making me very nice cups of coffee. So thank you.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, you talked a bit about it before. This is a really very nice neighborhood to walk through, to ride through, to kind of to experience what it's like, because it has a certain kind of sheltered quality that extends from here over to where you live. I mean, yeah, it's all part of that envelope between what the Prospect Park and Greenwood Cemetery.
Right.
It's cut off from a lot of other things.
And the expressway, too.
And the expressway.
The expressway, as much as it cuts right through the neighborhood, also kind of does lend this interesting sort of charm to it, too. When I used to live, this is years back, so this is almost 20 years, more like 15 years ago, I lived up the hill even farther. I lived across from the expressway, and we lived in this little, this one block little strip, you know it, between the cemetery and the expressway.
I do know that. You know, blocks.
Our mutual friend John used to live over there too at one point, but people used to come by and they'd say, does it bother you? It's, what are you talking about? They're like, the expressway, all the sound coming off the expressway, the trucks and the cars and whatever. This was like a year or so after I've been living there, and I said, I don't know what you're talking about. It just, you tune it out after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, we're a block away from the expressway right where we're sitting, and it's
very tranquil and quiet here. It raises a question, because as much as Garveyism is about, and by that I mean the series, I don't mean the ideology of Marcus Garvey or whatever. The series is about pressing questions, current events. You have this great article that you printed out in Three-Way Fight from Dandy Andy about Trumpism's multiple factions that we can talk about. But it's also about, I think, picking your brain a little bit. You have lived in this area for a long time. You have been in the struggle for a long time. You've seen, I think, probably the lowest point that this city has gotten to in the, some would say, in the mid-70s, right? Certainly the bankruptcy, 74, 75. But then you've also seen a great return of this city from disinvestment to reinvestment. So that's another thing I'd like to pick your brain about. Why is it that you, unlike a lot of, let's say, Irish-American working class kids, managed to, you move some blocks, you moved about 20, 30 blocks in your day, but you never moved all the way out to like the island or New Jersey or whatever. What was it about city life that that kept you here? Was it work or was it aesthetic?
My guess is I actually never considered moving away from the city. I lived for a few years in the Bronx, but other than that, my entire life has been in Brooklyn. Most of it within walking distance of where I grew up. Part of my parents lived here their entire lives. They never joined that suburban exodus. My one sister still lives here. Two live a little bit further away. Our children, I mean, this is skipping ahead a bit. We have three kids. They grew up on the block where we're sitting now. And there's perhaps an apocryphal tale that one year, my youngest daughter was coming home for my birthday, and she met her older sister at Penn Station, I guess. And then they were walking down the subway stairs to get the F train to come home, and they passed two people who were having a physical fight. They were punching each other, okay? And Elizabeth, who's all of about 5 feet 2 inches tall, okay, said, "I'm so glad to be home." I know, perhaps that was some bravado, but all of them, although our son now lives elsewhere, and he probably is, the city is a little bit too intense for him now after having spent time elsewhere. But the city was my home and it was their home, Brooklyn in particular.
Yeah.
And I'm glad about everything about those decisions I made. And also, I guess that another aspect of that is from the very end of college, but even a little bit before the end of college, I was immersed in various kinds of political projects, and they had some very strong power in holding on to me. That why would I leave, if it meant breaking with that? I mean, to give you just a couple of small examples. So I started driving a taxi in 1970 and did so for 8 years. Kind of striking that, a good friend dies 50 some odd years after I met him, and there are 5, 6, 7, 8 people, all of whom I've been friends with and they've been with me for all of those years.
Yeah.
And it's almost as if we all were at a meeting last night.
Sure.
That's how strong the connections were. And so that's part of the reason also why I stayed put.
And these were people that you were in political struggle with 50-something years ago, 55 years ago.
They were all people who had found their ways to driving a cab. They were, back then, first of all, driving a cab was a little bit more sane than it is now.
Wow, we've seen the documentary show Taxi. Right, with the
and so it's pretty dreadful out there now.
Yeah.
But it was a job that you could, do as little or as much as you wanted to. You got some money almost right away. Back then, my first apartment after college was in Greenpoint, it was $83 a month for four rooms. So I actually didn't have to work that much in order to come up with the rent.
Yeah, that's a novel concept.
Anyway, so all these people...
Being a cab driver was like how we would imagine like gig work nowadays. It was a good thing to fill in between.
It was, although I confess I had no idea where I was heading, what the in-between was. And I certainly wound up doing it for 8 years. And again, almost entirely due to the political connections that I had developed, so.
And you did at one point, and I'm recalling past conversations we had, you were involved in a taxi drivers unionization effort, essentially?
No, there was a union of cab drivers at the time. I call it the Taxi Workers Union. It was initiated by the then head of the Central Labor Council, Harry Van Arsdale, and bore all of the trademark features of something he would have done, kind of crappy conditions for the workers, shitty benefits, and
sort of
so
corporatist
on.
Relationship and so with the medallion.
Our group came to being and persisted in opposition to the leadership of the union, and more fundamentally, perhaps the deep structure of the union. It was not an accident the ways in which they were corrupt. They were corrupt in ways that were structured into the relationship the union had with the fleet owners. And so that was our defining challenge.
And now 50 years or so, the legacy of the Van Arsdale unionism as it existed is still around. And you guys fought this great battle to try to liberate the union, to liberate rank and file taxi drivers from this dead weight. How do you feel now, retrospectively, you guys did, and what possibilities were there that maybe you missed?
That's a good question. I mean, one I should mention is we've set up a webpage, Taxi Rank and File Coalition, and it has almost all of the kinds of significant documents that we produce, newspapers, flyers, position papers, internal debate documents, it's there for people to read. And there were some remarkable things about the group in terms of its internal ethos, that we kind of figured out ways of holding ourselves together through a lot of difficult challenges. And we ultimately lost all of the big battles, and there were two defining battles during those years. The first was that because of insurance regulations, the large fleets had come up with a device to reduce their liability in the case of accidents. And what that meant was that for every two cabs in their empire were reconstituted as a separate corporation, so that if one of those cabs was involved in an accident, the kind of the net worth of the corporation that you could sue against was limited to the two cabs, the medallions, and then the cars, which were incidental.
So legal chicanery, similar to, remember Johnson & Johnson lost that baby powder case recently, and they spun off the entire business that was liable for that, and they themselves...
Certainly analogous to that. And so what that led to is eventually the fleets decided, well, let's make this fiction into a little bit more of a reality. And they started selling off these two-cab units to what were known as mini-fleets, where individual drivers mortgaged themselves to purchase a mini-fleet, typically with another person. And that had the result of driving up the value of the medallion, which you needed to have in order to have operate a cab through the roof, and which had its own bad effects. But then, subsequently, the fleets decided that that was not enough, and they wanted to return to a method of reimbursing cab drivers that had been prevalent in the Depression, sometimes called leasing and sometimes called horse hiring.
Okay.
What that means is when I started driving a cab, I earned 49% of whatever was put on the meter. So if I booked, as they call it, $100, my share of that would be $49 plus tips.
Plus tips, sure.
And so I was guaranteed a certain, which it could fluctuate from day to day. Not every day were good days, but that was the way in which you got paid. Leasing, on the other hand, requires that the drivers pay in advance or the privilege of operating the cab for either a shift or a week or a month, and you only start making money after you've paid off the amount for the lease. And often enough, it doesn't work out that way.
Sure.
And you drive and drive and drive and wind up making pennies relatively. And so anyway, our last major battle was to stop that, the inclusion of that into the contract, and we lost.
You lost, okay.
I think that we were admired in some ways by an awful lot of cab drivers. They had sympathies for us. And they, I remember, perhaps I've bored you with this story before.
No.
That one day I was having in the what's called the shape up room, just like in construction, waiting for the cab to go out that night. And I got into this terrible argument with an older driver. And it was rooted in that then at that time there was a widespread reluctance, if not more, of cab drivers to pick up black folks and to take them often enough from the central city up to Harlem or to Bedford-Stuyvesant, one of the predominantly black neighborhoods. And it was something that we as a group were fighting against, that pattern.
Yeah.
And so anyway, we had this really bad argument, and apparently we had almost had to be sort of pulled apart before we had a physical fight, didn't get to that. But time went by, and a week or so later, it happened that he had drove his cab up to the gas station in the garage at the end of his day shift, and I was assigned that cab. So he left, I went in, I started driving out of the garage, and I was heading west, and it was the summer, and the sun was really bright. So I flipped down the visor, and lo and behold, there was a wad of bills clipped by a rubber band to the back of the visor, which was common amongst cab drivers.
That was his take for the day.
I turned around, went back to the garage, found him, and handed him the money. And I said something like, "You probably were nervous." He said, "No, I knew it was you."
Oh, he trusted you.
Now, I think that I don't think that's a unique experience. I think that people who are willing to embrace a fight, a struggle, earn the grudging respect, or not so grudging respect, of a lot of their fellow workers, even if it never quite takes the form of a self-conscious public affiliation.
They see this person as an agent, as somebody with responsibility. See somebody who's taken obligation upon themselves, so someone who's trustworthy, somebody who has something to say.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Anyway, The experience of driving a cab was an invaluable one for me. It's also what was then, in spite of how it being marginally better than it is today, a rough way to make a living.
Sure.
And there was no air conditioning in the cabs then, so hot summer days were hot summer days.
How about toilets?
And the cabs started falling apart overnight because cars were much less well-made then than they are now. But nonetheless, it was an invaluable experience. I learned a great deal.
Did you know where every toilet was in Manhattan, every public toilet?
I knew enough.
Enough to get by. Where did you typically drive back then?
That's another interesting story, Sean. When I first started, cab drivers were able to drive and pick up fares pretty much everywhere in the city that they were willing to go. You know, late at night, people who had gotten off the subway wanted to take a cab to go the last mile to get home and like that. Sunday morning, people wanted to go to church, all sorts of things. And what I started doing on Sundays, which is a very slow period of time when I was working days, is I would head to Bedford-Stuyvesant, and my garage was in Long Island City, so it was a bit of a distance away, because Bedford-Stuyvesant was filled with people who were going to church. And so I just spent my hours driving people back and forth to church, okay? And it was very easy. It was very nice. It was pleasant. The alternative to that is to drive in Manhattan during the week when what you're doing is you're driving people from the Upper East Side down to Wall Street and driving other people from Wall Street back to the Upper East Side and doing no socially useful stuff of any kind. But over time, amongst the other fleet owner strategies was a fairly intense campaign to reduce mileage, that they wanted you not only to put a lot of money on the meter, they also wanted you to do it with the least possible miles, because meant that they were paying more money for gas, and the cars were being run down more quickly.
Right, and they own the cars on
they
top of
the cars, they own the medallions, so you were dependent on them. And what that meant, for all practical purposes, you had to drive in Manhattan, because as soon as you went to the outer boroughs, you were going to almost certainly drive many more miles. And they actually put pressure on you to reduce the miles. And sometimes people were even disciplined for having too many miles.
Interesting.
And so over time, the job became more and more miserable.
Because there was more pressure from management, from ownership, really. And this is the reason why there was no yellow cabs in the outer boroughs until the green cabs came and filled. And that was under, I think, de Blasio, right? That was
the green cabs were under de Blasio. And previously, in 1966, right after New Year's, there was a subway strike. I know because my father was on strike. Mm. And during that time, obviously, cabs were one of the only ways of getting around for people. But especially inside, you know, kind of communities that didn't have very much taxi service, it gave rise to what were then called gypsy cabs.
Gypsy cabs,
who basically just kind of drove semi-legal ways.
This was the previous incarnation of car services?
Right, okay. Right. And now car services then and now are technically limited to only being able to pick people up who have called and made an arrangement, come to my house and pick me up. They cruised the streets. They picked up people on corners and whatever.
A 15-passenger van.
And after the strike ended, they continued, and they became the target of vicious attacks by the fleet owners and the union leaders. So it was another thing to fight about. But in any case, over time, that gave rise to a taxi industry here in the city, which is bewildering. You have Uber and Lyft, doing what they do by computer. You have the traditional car services, which operate by phone arrangements. You have the green cabs, which are allowed to operate in the outer boroughs and upper Manhattan. And then you have the remainder of the yellow cab industry, which for all practical purposes only really works between the kind of the bottom of Manhattan and 96th Street going towards Harlem and the airports.
That's it.
And although traffic, interestingly enough, is much less intense now than it was when I drove a cab.
Oh, really?
That perhaps is one of the odd consequences of congestion pricing immediately.
Yeah.
That traffic is not as crazy as it used to be. And that's, for people like cab drivers, that's a really very valuable development.
You and I were taking a car ride just before this because I forgot a microphone at my house. So we went and we were talking about the neighborhood, and we were talking about the sense that there's like, you know, different peoples in different times moving in and moving out, and different buildings being built, different types of buildings. There's like a sedimentary layers that exist. Sounds like, you know, the taxi industry in the city is the same way. You can isolate in your experience these moments like 1966, or these moments like the switch over from getting 49% to having to lease the vehicle as these inflection points. And then they, of course, take on an economic and social life of their own and continue until a new sort of innovation comes around. Uber and Lyft or whatever being the most recent ones, but like instead of replacing it, it's like an additive quality to it. It feels like so much of 21st century life is like that. Like we live in different periods. I feel like in my job, in my career, in my trade, in some cases, I still feel like I live in the 19th century. You know, the way the hierarchies and the way that people deal with one another and operate with one another, the old craft union rules that we can still manage to impose on some of the employers is a distinctly like 19th century craft experience. But yet we're using $10 million machines that were built in Europe, you know, and sent over to the United States. I feel like, you know, maybe that is what history is like a vast accumulation of different periods, different inflection points, different moments that all kind of add up to this behind the scenes world that we exist within, but don't understand all the ins and outs of.
Yeah, that sounds right to me, Sean. I confess I never thought of it quite that way. I think that perhaps the one exception to that pattern is when certain jobs and industries are obliterated, where right. They simply are wiped out. Many years ago, I visited Chicago, maybe for the first time, visiting with a friend, and he brought me somewhere on the shore of Lake Michigan, and he basically waved his arm, said, "Cross the way, John, okay, there are 150,000 workers."
Oh, towards Gary, towards the steel
mills? Yeah, much of
that
was in the steel mills. So yeah. Much of that has vanished from the earth. And the consequences for neighborhoods like South Chicago are pretty devastating. That what had, you know, previously been a really solid, stable community with all of the virtues of those urban neighborhoods disappeared. And they come up with really trivial replacements of, you know, a factory that's going to bring jobs to the South Side, okay? And it turns out there are 17 jobs.
You know? Right. The big thing over the last few years has been data centers. So data centers, I know people who are electricians who have just spent the last few years just wiring up these humongous data centers over and over and over again. But once they're up, once they're wired up, once they're tilted up, once these buildings are completed and hooked up to the grid, there's two or three jobs maybe that exist. And this is more and more, I feel like, this great crisis that we're facing right now. If you believe statistics, and that's always dangerous, they say that there's been a jobs recession that's arisen over the last year, 6 months to a year or so. But it's not in the steel mills of Gary, because those don't exist anymore. It's in entry-level white-collar employment, specifically. And this, I think a lot of this might be capital management looking at the potential effects of AI in replacing a lot of these jobs. Part of it, too, seems to be something that overlaps maybe with the MAGA agenda, which is the culling of like a whole sort of middle stratum of social managers, of like middle management and lower middle management, whose job is to in the Trump case, like increase diversity, but in other cases, like do marketing and market research and things of that sort. It seems like there's a big purge with that right now. So maybe I don't think we're going to have a huge a burst of jobs on Lake Michigan in Gary. And I don't think that the steel mills necessarily are going to be humming like the 1950s. I think we're going to have maybe problems we didn't anticipate in industries and sectors we didn't anticipate as this sort of political and social chaos that's been unleashed over the last 10 years works itself out.
I agree that the unlikely or unanticipated, rather, consequence of the introduction of artificial intelligence as a data software application broadly defined is mostly or primarily going to affect not so much the people who have the lowest level jobs in the hierarchy. So, for example, the Amazon people who deliver, you know, by running around in the streets.
They're already algorithmically controlled, right?
Right. And so you no longer have someone like a dispatcher who's telling you, all right, you go on this route, you go on that route, and to some extent is responsible for developing the routes so that the right. labor is divided in a way that from their point of view is most efficient.
Right.
That's going to be gone because it can be replaced by the efficient management of data, the very rapid efficient management of data, and that I think that there are going to be a lot of people who are going to wake up one morning surprised that just like some of what's been going on, this was not supposed to happen to me.
Right.
And
it's perhaps your experience in the taxi industry that leads you to bring up the dispatcher. I wouldn't have thought of that, but that's a very interesting one because there's whole industries, you know, these, I guess what Marx called in volume two, the faux fray of production, right? These kind of costs that exist within production, these sort of middle layers of market research, logistics, you know, dispatching things, management, things of this sort, that you're right, you know, are deeply imperiled right now. Maybe not everything can be done by computer, by large language models or whatever the, you know, AI equivalent is, but certainly vast changes are coming down the pipes.
I think so.
Is your son's a doctor, right?
Is he?
What is his take on all this? Because they're coming for doctors and nurses.
I think that
they want to.
We haven't spoken a lot about it. It's my impression that there are things that artificial intelligence models can do that are beyond the capacity of any even relatively large and well-connected group of people can do. Let's say, for example, that you want to investigate effective treatments for prostate cancer, just to make up something. And it would take any particularly talented oncologist, even working with others, many, many years to read through all of the accumulated literature on any particular topic within that field.
Sure.
Since virtually all of the kind of print data that's available electronically has now been scooped up by the artificial intelligence managers, the reading through all of that text can be accomplished rapidly, and it's possible to ascertain a potentially valuable remedy for some treatment of cancer
sure.
that would be beyond the capacity of any one particular person. Now, I think that takes care of part of the traditional or non-traditional role of doctors. It doesn't take care of making wise judgments. It doesn't take care of making judicious decisions about treatments. There's going to be plenty of work. And I would suggest that in this country and maybe many other places, the challenge we have amongst many challenges is not that there are too many doctors, but rather that there are too few, that people who work in hospitals and other settings are pretty dragged out. They're exhausted by what they have to do. And that's barely scratching the surface of the problems with healthcare. But all of these kinds of innovations make possible choices of which way for us to go. Do we move towards a more humane, more rational organization of the necessary work of our society, or do we simply use it to accelerate the drive towards capital accumulation? I think you and I know the answers to that question for the moment. All of the potential benefits of innovations like artificial intelligence are going to be almost certainly squandered on, you know, relatively trivial matters, but all of which can generate profit.
Right. Yeah. And the big profit, of course, is in automating away types of human labor that haven't been possible to automate away.
Yes.
Exactly those white collar middle management type jobs. You know, I'm reading, have you ever read Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy?
I've read about it, but no, I haven't read the book.
It's very good. I'm rereading it. I don't know what it was about these books that grabbed me again, but it's been 15 years, 12, 15 years since I read it, so I picked up Red Mars again. You know, and what struck me about it was comparing and contrasting what Kim Stanley Robinson, who's like a William Morris type socialist, you know, imagines the role of technology and say what actually existing Mars colonization, how it imagines it, of course, which is Elon Musk's SpaceX program, right? This big drive to go to Mars. I have to check myself sometimes because I'm so cynical about Elon Musk and the and his supporters and their conception of Mars colonization, their boosting of their industry, their raiding of the public treasury, and the technology essentially being used for what feels like a glorified ego trip, basically, for the richest man in the world. I contrast that to the vision in say Red Mars, where there's all these great technologies, all these great innovations that are brought to bear in a situation where, unlike, say, on Earth, unlike in New York City in the 21st century, such as we live right here, labor-saving devices cause all sorts of social conflicts and social tensions. People lose their jobs. They go on unemployment. Whole industries, as you said, are destroyed. In the situation put forth in this kind of speculation of what Mars colonization could look like in Kim Stanley Robinson, automations and innovations are directly put into like a situation of intense scarcity and necessary solidarity that comes from being only 100 people, you know, in deep space on a planet somewhere. And there's something sad and tragic, I think, about the way that we're seeing people like Elon Musk and Silicon Valley and Sam Altman and all of their boosters in Washington and London and elsewhere, how they're applying this technology and how out of control it feels, and how we should feel, how I should feel cynical about technology, because I don't want to feel cynical about it. These are true human potentials. These are transformative powers that we're developing for ourselves, but they turn to ashes in our hands when they're put towards these very noxious programs that our capitalist class comes up with, and oftentimes uses the capitalist state to midwife. And so I guess what I'm saying is that I really wish it was possible to be less cynical about this stuff, less cynical about AI, less cynical about Mars colonization, less cynical about technology, because I feel like, I don't know, we've lost something from the 19th and 20th century, this Promethean drive, which had its own problems for sure, but now any progress, it feels like my first instinct is to associate it with capital, bad, you know, disruption, bad, grifting, bad, you know, and that's a real shame, I think.
I agree, Sean. It reminds me, as you were talking about that, not very well known Russian revolutionary by the name of Alexander Bogdanov, in I think 1910, maybe 1912. Wrote a science fiction novel called Red Star, which is actually about kind of life on Mars after a period of colonization or occupation. I'm not sure what it was called. And the use of then the technology that he imagined was all devoted to the most efficient use of labor time so that it could be as much as humanly possible reduced and people would have more free time. It was not used to accelerate production and to basically to result in people working harder longer,
right,
but to work less and more efficiently. The that kind of current inside the revolutionary movement has been very subdued for a long time. Yeah. I think a certain kind of anti-technology, anti-science predisposition has been pervasive, and yeah. I think it's understandably so, perhaps because of the terrible uses that scientific knowledge are being put to, whether it's the atomic bomb or whatever.
Or Love Canal, or Three Mile Island.
And it's going to be one of the tasks of facing a revolutionary movement, and then beyond that, a revolutionary moment, is how to rewire those circuits to make science and technology not kind of subservient to inhuman kinds of purposes and ends, but rather to be profoundly shaped by the needs and desires of human beings.
Yeah.
Now that's a tall order, right?
It is. It is.
And I think that, you know, I often enough read things by mostly people who I like, who talk about the need for us to have a genuine vision of what an alternative society could look like writ large. And what's interesting and somewhat disappointing is people tend too often to leave that conversation off at that point.
Yeah.
They say that it's necessary for us to have that kind of vision, but too little time and effort is devoted to actually beginning to imagine and articulate it in ways that are reasonably comprehensible by lots of ordinary people, not just by us. And that's really necessary work. Now, that probably requires, and this is something that you and I have talked about on other occasions, that the capacity of the overwhelming majority of human beings to comprehend a sufficient understanding, to acquire a sufficient understanding of scientific understandings of the world and of the shaping of the world and of the challenges as well in that. I mean, how do you, is it possible to develop fuel technologies that really don't wind up in terrible damage to the earth?
Yeah.
That's a question. It's not an answer.
Yeah.
But those are questions that need to be posed to and answered by the vast majority of people, not by self-selected or any other way of selecting experts.
Right.
excuse me. I think that if we make a list of all the things we need to do, it would be a pretty long list.
Yeah, I think it would, but I'm tantalized by the example that you brought up earlier, which is when you made yourself political on the job, when you intervened politically in a small bore situation. Like, not that there weren't hundreds and thousands of people involved in the taxi cab industry at the time and the union that you were in, but like, you know, on a smaller scale, when you intervened, you at least got the grudging respect of even your enemies, even the reactionaries, the racists or whatever, and they trusted you. I feel like the left, and I don't even know what that means anymore in the age of Trump. I don't know what the left means, but I feel like you're 100% right that these kind of proposals, these conceptions, these pre-political or political ideas of what the world could be, outside of, I think, a gray, cold, statist, progressive ideology that we've all kind of, I think, for real reasons, material reasons, have been forced to kind of fall back upon something that's far less statist and far more creative and far more Promethean and far more acknowledging of like the limits, the capacities, not that we have, but certainly that our planet has. Something like that, I think, is absolutely necessary right now. And I wonder if that's a task that like a Trumpist left can take up. It reminds me of this article that you printed out from Three Way Fight, where this Dandy Andy gentleman talks about the factions that exist within the MAGA movement, Trump being one of them, but only one of many. And what this might mean. Andy takes the questions of whether this is fascism or not and says we have to put that aside and offers up basically like at the end of it, a series of ways that a mass movement might arise and what it would confront. So what was it that drew you to this piece, and what do you think of Dandy Andy's theses here?
Dandy Andy is someone who I know, okay. But I have not ever met. We've had some email correspondence. One thing that's quite interesting is that he's Canadian. Uh-huh. And if people read that article, one of the things I think they'll be struck by is how much he knows about the United States. And
it's pretty typical for Canadians.
I think that he at the end, if I recall correctly, he makes an argument that one is that opposition to the developing Trump MAGA project has got to be deeply and consistently anti-capitalist. Mm-hmm. He doesn't elaborate too terribly much on that in this article, but he also says that it's going to be absolutely essential for people who embrace that kind of anti-capitalist politics and are prepared to act, to be willing to get their hands dirty, I think is the metaphor he uses, by going into the actually existing mass and emerging mass movements that are on the streets, even though the explicit or implicit politics of those movements is very far away from an anti-capitalist revolutionary response, and to become seen within those movements as people who are part of it, people who contribute to it, people who are willing to go along with the decisions of the majority, and then at the same time to be prepared, to articulate, you know, the kind of the challenges beyond the immediate one and the possibilities beyond the immediate one. And I think that that's a wise prescription, that we need to do both things. And that, you know, many years ago, I was very much influenced by a South African revolutionary by the name of Neville Alexander, who was on the left wing of then revolutionary politics in South Africa. He was a critic of the ANC, for example, prior to its emergence as the leader of the new country, and then subsequently, he died some time ago now. But in one essay that he wrote, which was he is a kind of one of the principles of the anti-apartheid movement was non-cooperation with the existing state structures. So if the apartheid government set up some form of pretend democratic structure in a township or whatever, the ANC and other groups consistently refused to participate.
Abstentionism.
Non-collaboration. Yeah. We don't work with them at all. They're the arm of the enemy, so to speak. But then he kind of said, but let's stop and think about this a bit. Let's imagine that someone who we're engaged with is a member of the ANC, and that individual, someone who is knowledgeable politically, embraces a collaborationist stance. Absolutely, we have to oppose them, challenge them, and deal with them in that way. On the other hand, if some worker is new to political struggle and comes to a first meeting or a second meeting and is unfamiliar with the terrain of what are the debates, whatever, and happens to say, I think we should participate in this new kind of thing that's coming along because it gives us a chance to say what we think.
You denounce them as a collaborator.
No. And I think that's very wise to understand that you need to be prepared to do and to respond to different things in different ways, and there's not a prescription that you follow for any and all purposes. And that's a very wise perspective, and that there are lots of opportunities for us. Now, very important is the other problem, or the other danger, is to get so absorbed in the existing movements that there is no distinctive voice, no distinctive presence, no distinctive perspective.
Right.
And that, so at our current moment, one of the aspects of that might be is that the recent tours of Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the billionaires, the anti-billionaires rallies, whatever, okay? It's remarkable and encouraging that thousands of people are showing up, but I don't think that we kind of help things very much along by joining in the various choruses demanding Medicare for all or free college education.
Yeah.
That is an impoverishment of the kind of possibilities that we need to embrace. And I would say at this late point, the possibilities we need to embrace are perilously close to the absolute necessities that we need to embrace, because if we don't, the outcomes are almost certainly going to be awful.
Well, I think that's as good a spot to leave it as any. I think we'll maybe do some final points, and then we'll close it out. And remember, there's only episode one, so we got plenty more episodes to spin this out. Go ahead, John.
Can I interrupt?
Yeah, please.
Can we stop for just a moment?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm back, Sean. I apologize.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We should always stop to say goodbye to our wives when they leave the door. And if you don't, criminal. Bye. So long. Thanks. But we are, I think, winding down at this point, and I would wholeheartedly agree. I think, and maybe this is something we'll spin out, a thread we'll spin out, but there's been this tendency, I feel like, among communists, among revolutionaries, among socialists, whatever, two tendencies. The first is not to learn any lessons from the late, great Bernie Sanders movement. And I think this speaking tour that Bernie and AOC is on, and maybe to a lesser extent, but partially to the mayoral candidacy of Zoran, is an attempt to patch together something which fell apart in practice, which is a sort of like progressive slash socialist coalition for local, state, or national politics. But the other thing I think, and the darker thing, but maybe something with we can think about potentials that might exist out of is, okay, well, we've tried to tail the Democrats for 40 years, 50 years or whatever, since the 1960s or 70s. Time to start tailing the Republicans. Let's start tailing MAGA, right? So when you're entering township politics, right, you could imagine you're entering in the resistance as we saw it 8 years ago. Remember these great big marches that existed? You could imagine yourself as a communist intervening in that situation. But lately, some people have said, well, as a communist, I'm going to start intervening in MAGA rallies, you know, and that this is some natural constituency instead. And I think that, like, these are two very similar mistakes, but I think it makes sense that, like, certain people on the left, having kind of trailing the left wing of the Democratic Party into the ground, are now trying something else. I think it's foolhardy, but I think it does point to some interesting questions about what the working class is in this country, what a working class political movement might look like, whether the politics of that would be closer to the politics of the Democratic or the Republican Party, or something completely different, something completely out of left field, maybe some combination of them. And that stuff maybe we can tease out later. I'm not sure if you had some final thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things, one of the many things we lack is a vehicle or a venue or an arena, whatever the right metaphor is, to have serious and sustained discussions about what you just talked about.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is that there are arguably, in comparison to what the situation was when I was young, more publications, more essays, more articles published by radical Marxist anarchists, even of one stripe or another, than is possible for any one of us to read.
Sure.
I'm sometimes a pretty fast reader, but I certainly can't. And on the other hand, there's a relative poverty of genuine, substantial debate.
Yeah.
And I think we need new forms of ways of engaging ourselves and hopefully larger concentric circles of other people in serious discussions. I don't think that needs to be understood as we need to have grand theoretical discussions. I think that it's valuable for us to be able to think through complicated matters, and to some extent that involves some theoretical considerations. But I think we need to become more accustomed to taking seriously the need for debate in the best possible sense of debate, not debate understood as I clobber you before you clobber me.
Or dueling threads on X.com or something like that. Or long Facebook screeds.
One of the groups that I was very much influenced by in my earlier years was a group called Sojourner Truth Organization.
Oh, sure.
And a man named Mike Stoudemire, who lives in Chicago, wrote a really fine history of that book called Truth in Revolution. And I believe that it may have been his subtitle, I'm not sure, but at some point or other he quoted an expression from the organization, which was they imagine themselves trying to be revolutionaries who think. And that sounds kind of obvious in some ways, but it's unfortunately not nearly as well established a guiding principle. And that part of that thinking is thinking about the need to be considerate of each other, that we don't win arguments by belittling, we don't win arguments by out-theorizing, by out-quoting, or any of those things. We win arguments in ways that we begin to illuminate for people ways of thinking about what they're looking at that are different in some important fashion from what they've previously done. Now, at the same time, we have to be prepared to do the same thing ourselves. We cannot be so convinced that we have it all figured out and there's nothing more for us to do other than to say it louder.
I fundamentally agree with all of that. I think that's kind of the purpose of the ILC. And tomorrow night, I'll leave this on the podcast, even though this might come out after, there is an ILC event that Ross Wolf put together about education.
Where and when is that, Sean?
It's in Manhattan. I'll have to find the information. I'll put it in the show notes for all of you at home, but I will text you the flyer. That's really wonderful.
But these
are the sort of things, what you're saying are the sort of things that we've already sort of been trying to engage in, but it's so difficult because I feel like, and maybe this is part of the larger Antifada project, so much of the left seems to be caught up in thought terminating cliches and dogmas, whether Marxism, Leninism, or like Bernie Sandersism or whatever, that even beginning this process, being a revolutionary who thinks, I think, is a tall order. But it's a good place to start because I'm not sure that we've even learned the lessons of the 20th century yet sufficient to move into the 21st century.
What's that old thing? A small step of actual movement as far as a million whatever.
I think that if
something that Ross is doing, and Ross always does serious things, that's great as a start. We'll see what happens.
So small beginnings, right? If a man wants to move a mountain, he starts by carrying small stones, I think is the idea. Thank you, everybody, for listening
to episode one.
John, it's been a real pleasure, as always. And I don't know. I feel like I'd be up for another one soon.
Yep, let's do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, maybe next week or the week after.
That sounds good.
All right, take care, brother. Thanks, everyone, for listening. So long.
Catch them.